I'm Ken Hemmings, and he is Chris Lang, and welcome to another of these regular property briefings. Again, a warm welcome to you, Chris.
Well, it's always a pleasure, Ken.
Because it seems to be a favourite with our listeners, I thought we might return to the topic of negotiating. And today I'd like to cover your top negotiating tips. So, where do we start?
Well, the place I always start with clients is with the fundamental principle that I always adopt, and that is never allow the negotiation to be narrowed down to just one single issue. And that's the number one rule that you need to know as an expert negotiator. I mean, negotiation is a very crucial game, which has its own specific set of rules. And you've probably heard it said that whoever prepares the agenda is the one who controls the meeting. And the same principle is used when it comes to buying commercial property. Now, during the course of a negotiation, you can generally find out a lot about the other party's viewpoint. But it all comes down to paying close attention to how they respond to everything you say and do. And most people tend to make an offer for a commercial property based solely on the price. And when you stop to think about it, you're not only acting in your own best interest, really, because, you know, as a business consultant, you never submit a quote. The word quote indicates that you're immediately open to negotiation. Instead, you would always refer to it as a fee proposal. And likewise, when it comes to commercial property, you're not in the business of making offers. You're making a purchase proposal. Now, in any proposal I put forward on behalf of a client, I have at least three, in most cases, four different components. The first one is the amount of the deposit. Now, you see, I generally propose that you have an initial deposit of 5% on the basis of signing the contract or the exchange of contract, whereas the additional 5%, making up a total of 10, would be paid upon the completion of a satisfactory due diligence. And I'm assuming the property is worth, you know, $1 million or perhaps more. So there is some work that you have to do. So you build a due diligence period into it, which leads us to the next thing, which is this due diligence study. Now, you don't do that before you sign the contract. You make it part of the contract. So it's effectively a conditional contract. Now, I would generally request 21 business days to give you time to verify the integrity of what you're buying, both from a physical and a financial point of view. So that forms part of the contract. Now, when you're buying a commercial property, the price is obviously important. And you need to put in, to start with, what I would call your lowest realistic amount. In other words, some people want to lowball, and the problem with that is that you actually start to aggravate the vendor. So you have to have a realistic figure, and it's got to be believable. And then you have your settlement terms. Now, you might initially start out by seeking 120 days and then work back from there. So, you see, as I said, with your deposit, you've got that plus three other things to negotiate on. Initial 5% plus 5. Ultimately, you might end up paying 10% up front. 21 business days. And if you stop to think about it, it's pretty close to a month by the time you take in the weekends. Now, I can get a study done in 7 business days, which is effectively 10 days. So, again, there's room to move. On the price, you put in a realistically low figure, but still within striking distance, you'll come up a bit on that. Your settlement terms, 120 days. Well, you know, normally it's 60, so you work your way back from 120 to 90 and then ultimately 60. But you've got four balloons in the air at once. So the vendor is not just focused on price. The vendor is focused, I want to get the shortest settlement, I want to get a bit more deposit, I want to shorten the due diligence period. So all these things are negotiated simultaneously so that the vendor might be important, the settlement's important. So therefore, if they can get it back to 60 days, that's more important to them than an extra maybe $10,000 on the price, because they have a loan commitment falling due and they don't want to have to refinance it and the costs of another valuation, all that sort of stuff. So, you know, that's important. You might be in a position to settle in 30 days because you have just cash sitting there and you've got your loan already organised. So, as I said, this is the fundamental thing, is never just focus on price alone.
Tell me, what does it take to become a master negotiator?
When it comes to negotiating, there are probably four or five characteristics that stand out that make you a good negotiator. The first one is the preparedness to seek information. And I mentioned that before, that you can generally find out a fair amount before the negotiation begins. But to be successful, you need to put in the prep time to gather all that information and never simply accept what you're told without doing some close probing. And you need to be like a good reporter and research. And on the basis of what you find out, you then come up with a sound, well-planned-out strategy based on certain assumptions. Now, the next characteristic is that you need to be a good listener. Now, if you listen carefully, you'll uncover the party's real needs, and only then can you work towards achieving a win-win outcome. Now, you obviously start by showing genuine interest when they talk. You know, I mean, lean in, tilt your head slightly, ask questions, and give them feedback by rephrasing a point they might have just made. Your focus should be on the message rather than the actual delivery. Now, if possible, take notes to show that you value what you're being told. And also, doing that has two other side benefits. It saves you time and will avoid arguments later by recording what was said. But also, the other party tends to be more truthful about what it is they're telling you if, in fact, you're writing it down. Now, remember, always wait until they finish before you reply, and don't allow any personal bias to start to flavour your responses. Now, the next characteristic is you need to be a strategic thinker. This simply means planning out every detail of your negotiation. You can get mind mapping software, which you don't need that, but it's helpful. But you can simply use a pen and paper or a whiteboard to get that done. But as you develop your ideas, you tend to discover that you'll need to record or perhaps reorder the sequence as they flow. And that's harder to do when it's written down rather than using software. So maybe a combination of the two of them, but you need to have a clear flow of logic. Next is having the virtue of being patient. Just being tough is not going to make you a top negotiator. A master negotiator is very patient, so that even strong arm tactics by the other party won't actually intimidate you, and nor will you be able to be forced in concluding a deal that's anything other than a win-win outcome. But at the end of the day, probably persistence is what will often win the day, because sometimes that's the only card got left to play. And when all else fails, persistence is sometimes the only thing that will get you across the line. I mean, there will be times when the other party will throw up countless objections, and they do that simply to see if you've got what it takes to stay the distance. And when they realise that you're there for the long haul, you know what you're talking about, well, invariably they'll come round to your point of view.
So that more or less covers necessary characteristics investors need to have. What about any specific skills?
Well, when it comes to skills, I mean, just being able to think on your feet is obviously important. But you need to also project yourself as an expert. And you do this by you know, subtly establishing your background and credentials. You know, as the world becomes more complicated, more and more power shifts to the experts, probably more so than they even realise. And, you know, once you master a skill, you need to maintain it and improve it. And so these days, expert power is important, but it can be overused. And sometimes people, you know, flout that by using sort of in-house jargon to make themselves sound more superior than they actually are. And quite often you've got to disarm them simply by, you know, using a phrase like, look, I'm not sure, I quite understand. In fact, I think you may have lost me a few minutes ago. Now, that's really, I suppose, combining irreverence with innocence. You're very politely letting them know that their carry-on just left you for dead. So, you know, you'll find very quickly discover that something like that is all it takes to regain or retain the initiative. Now, to help you achieve that, there are perhaps a couple of things you need to consider is that, you know, don't even attempt to answer if you're not prepared to. And also never be afraid to answer any question with a question. You know, you don't ask about something that you don't want to talk about. And after you ask a question, keep quiet and let them tell you the answer. Don't continue on the conversation. And every so often, try asking a question you already know the answer to. And, you know, sometimes you've got to restate your understanding of what the other party said. Also, you never want to be rude or offensive. And feel free to use conditional or hypothetical statements until you are certain of the point that you're wishing to make.
They say negotiating involves compromise. How do you actually go about achieving that?
Well, the secret here is that you always need to trade concessions for concessions. I mean, posing an open-ended question or request often works best. In other words, instead of nominating a specific price, you might say, look, you're going to have to come down on your price if we're going to make this work. But even if you only ask for something quite small, always ask them for something in return. I mean, if you simply concede to some concession or minor item early on, that might open the floodgates to a whole lot of other minor concessions if you don't get something in return. Plus, you enhance the perceived value of whatever it is that you're conceding. I mean, with one specific party, I had made several purchase proposals and negotiations had stalled. So I set up a meeting with the vendor and their selling agent. The only reason for not having a client there was to be able to refer to a higher authority if the need arose. And the vendor announced that for this to work for him, my client needed to come up another $20,000 on price. And as it turned out, this really wasn't a problem for my client. She could go up another $50,000 or more the way things currently stood. Therefore, my response was, that might be possible, but I'll need to check with my client first on that. But if she was prepared to do that, would you agree to extend the settlement to 180 days and allow us access to renovate after 30 days? Now, at this point, the vendor thought he'd achieved what he was after as far as the price was concerned and simply needed to agree to what I was asking in return. However, I was actually seeking commitment from the vendor before my client was required to agree to the increase in price. Now, the property was actually vacant and I knew the timing of the settlement was not really an issue for the vendor, so why wouldn't the vendor agree? But the selling agent was also a good negotiator and quickly said, if the vendor agrees to that, would your purchaser be prepared to pay a further 10% deposit when access is granted in 30 days? So you see how someone skillful understands, yes, concession being asked, but you've got to get something in return. So at this point, you need to tie everything down. And so you say, well, if I can get my client to agree to all of that, do we have a deal? Again, you'll notice I was seeking to gain pre-commitment from the vendor before Mike's required to make a decision. So really, therefore, the exchange of compromising was complete and the parties had traded several items, but both parties now felt they had a deal that would work for them. Now, the extra 10% deposit was worth far less than the additional month's gain for renovation, which would allow the property to be renovated pre-leased prior to settlement. The vendor obviously felt more comfortable with a 20% deposit after 30 days, and upgrades to the property that we were doing only added value if my client were to default prior to settlement. So as you can see, you end up with a win-win situation.
During a negotiation, are you expected to agree to everything on the spot?
Well, the simple answer is no, because there will be times you need to buy time or perhaps gain a little breathing space during a negotiation. So how could you do that? What might you be able to do? Well, obviously, experience is valuable, but in a negotiation, it's vital. And after some practice, you'll quickly develop your own style and be able to implement some of these simple techniques. But there will be times when you may still find yourself being backed into a corner. Now, rule number one in negotiating is whoever blinks first loses. So for you to possess any real power in negotiation, you need to be prepared to leave your ego at the door. And also, as I mentioned before, be prepared to refer key decisions to a higher authority. Now, that could be some sort of distant committee or board or your client or a financial planner. But when you reach a brick wall, you know, sometimes the other party simply won't budge from a certain price. And it could be helpful to say something like, I'd be wasting everyone's time taking your proposal to my financial planner at that price level. Now, effectively, your aim is to unsettle the other side by revealing that they're not actually dealing with the ultimate decision maker. Now, this should cause them to provide something worthy of consideration by a higher authority, but it means you're not the bad guy in this. Now, exactly who that authority may be is not vital. In fact, the vaguer, the better. But as a master negotiator, you realise the beauty of having to obtain approval from someone else. You can then sort of sidestep any potential confrontation. As I said, you're the good guy and the other party's the bad guy, the higher authority. Now, in the case the party doesn't have authority to decide, you need to deftly push their envelope and discover the full extent of the range for the deal to work for you. So you then need to try and influence the decision to be made by the higher authority. And there's a couple of things you could do. I mean, everyone loves to feel important. If you stroke their ego properly, the other party should guide you to the basis of a deal that their higher authority would approve. But also what you can do is enlist their support for the deal, even offer to negotiate directly with that higher authority to avoid any misunderstanding by having the details conveyed through a third party. So there are several ways that you can do that. But no, you don't have to make a decision on the spot, but you also need to cope with someone else that seems to want to use that same ploy against you.
I realise we haven't covered everything, but I'm sure our listeners gained a number of helpful takeaways from today. So thank you for that.
Well, look, negotiation can become involved, but it's very much a learned skill. So if anyone would like to discover more, I'll provide you with a link to my negotiating masterclass, which you could include on the webpage under this podcast.